Does COVID-19 put you at higher risk for psychiatric problems?
Can we automatically identify adults that are in the hospital that are at risk of deteriorating?
Does telework help reduce rates of COVID-19?
And using our cell phones to model COVID-19 infection rates and how that should determine what closes and what reopens.
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lyon, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And still, unfortunately, in that part of the curve, the whole country really is watching you, the epicenter for COVID-19 transmission and infection.
As you suggest, Elizabeth, we've got more people hospitalized in El Paso than 29 states in the union. So it's a significant issue here. Again, kudos to our hospital partners that are working with us to meet the needs here in the community. So thanks for keeping us in your thoughts.
Yes, of course. All of us. So 3 out of 4 this week looking at COVID issues. And once again, I'm going to let you determine which of the two of yours you'd like to start with.
Let's start this one about using a cell phone. This is a really unique study. It's come from the journal Nature, and it talks about using mobility networks to model COVID-19 infections and actually how they can explain some of the inequities that we're seeing and also inform some of our reopening. They used data derived from a cell phone that mapped the hourly movement of 98 million people from different neighborhoods, what they call census block groups, across the nation to points of interest, things like restaurants and religious establishments and gyms and such things like that. In doing so, they were able to connect over 57,000 of these census block groups with over 530,000 points of interest, looking at 5.4 billion hourly edges. So that's a tremendous amount of data. And what they show when they integrate all that stuff together and they map that on top of people that are either susceptible, exposed, infected, or recovered, is they can actually fit their model to exactly what's going on, not only in one large metropolitan area, but in 10 different metropolitan areas around the country. Using that model, they're able to predict that a small minority of super spreaders at certain points of interest account for the large majority of infections. And by the way, if you know that, you can restrict not everything, but you can restrict activity at those points of interest. They also showed that if they restricted mobility, stay-at-home orders, there was an inequity in that because the people that have a lot of money are much more able to reduce their mobility than individuals in a lower income. So that's not particularly helpful. These lower income individuals were more likely to be at points of interest that were more crowded and more likely to have infected individuals as well. So by capturing who is infected at which locations, we can provide models that inform us the most effective ways and the most equitable ways to modify policy to reduce COVID-19 infection.
Interestingly, just this morning, I got a solicitation from the state of Maryland asking if I would like to opt in to allowing myself to be monitored via my cell phone and utilizing Bluetooth so that the state would be able to notify me if I had a potential exposure to COVID-19. I think when we take this study and a lot of other studies and other information that's out there right now, we're learning that our strategies for intervention need to be focused on these super spreaders versus a more dispersed model of spreading such as we had had previously with influenza. I have a fundamental objection to being monitored on my cell phone, but on the other hand, I feel like, wow, if this is going to contribute to us being able to get our arms around this in a way that also improves our economic and social stabilities, that's probably a good trade.
Yeah, it probably is, Liz, but I agree with you. Now, this particular data is all anonymized, so it wasn't passed to individual cell users. What it does is it informed policymakers. So, for example, they looked at a number of different points of interest. I'm thinking of things like full-service restaurants and fitness centers and merchandise stores and pet stores and hobby stores and automotive department stores, physicians' offices, etc., to determine that if you reopen these different points of interest, how many more infections you would have. And you wouldn't be surprised to know, for example, reopening department stores, very few infections, but reopening full-service restaurants, significant number of infections. So you're right, using that anonymized information to not inform the cell phone holders, but inform policymakers can be a very important tool in preventing the spread of COVID-19.
Okay, let's transition from here to a morbidity and mortality weekly report. And this also is an intervention that appears to be a good deal more targeted. And that's how does telework impact on the rate of transmission among adults in the U.S.? This is a case control investigation to compare telework between eligible symptomatic persons who received positive SARS-CoV PCR tests versus symptomatic persons with negative test results, control participants. They really attempted to get a lot of people involved in this study, but by the time they honed down into eligibility, they ended up with case patients of 153 and control participants of 161. Among those folks, the case patients, only 35% of them were able to telework, while 53% of the control participants were able to do that. When they started looking at some of the other factors, you've already identified one of them. If you have a higher income, you're more eligible to work at home. And so that was absolutely one of the factors that was related to whether you could telework and whether you could reduce the potential that you were going to be infected with COVID-19. They suggested that 26% of U.S. adults were teleworking because of COVID-19 during July of this year. And that is in contrast to other reports of teleworking options that suggest it might be higher. They say that we really need to work hard to expand those options, even to people who are at other income brackets, so that we can help to reduce the transmission. Although they do also say that most of the community exposures were not associated with teleworking. So when somebody did seroconvert or get infected, it wasn't related to their teleworking option.
It's a great study. And they took a bunch of symptomatic people. Some had COVID, some didn't. And they said, how often did you telework? And obviously the people that didn't have COVID were more likely to telework. Now you might ask the question, well, what about the people that didn't telework? Where were they going? A large number of the people were going exclusively to the office or to a school setting, and they were still twice as likely to get COVID infected as those that teleworked. You might say, well, that's because they're essential workers, but no, it really wasn't essential workers. If you went to an office or a school setting and it wasn't non-essential, you're still more likely to get infected. So we need to, as a community and a society, provide the option to work from home or telework whenever possible.
Yep, at least for right now, until we get our arms around more of this transmission data. Let's turn to your really interesting one in the New England Journal of Medicine. Can we predict when a patient is going to experience acceleration of their decline using artificial intelligence?
More, I'm going to say, automated information gathered from the electronic medical record. This was a study centered in the Kaiser Permanente network of 21 different hospitals. We have a number of different ways of predicting who will do poorly in an intensive care unit setting, but we have not quite so many and not quite so robust ways of determining just a routine hospitalized patient. What you'd like to be able to do is identify who's going to deteriorate, not at the time they're doing it, because that's almost too late to intervene, but you want to be able to identify hours before so you can try to correct or identify, get teams working on these individuals. So what the Kaiser Permanente Network did is they looked at their electronic medical record and ascertained what variables could predict that. They did this in two hospitals, and then they rolled this out to the other 19 hospitals over a period of time. And what they were able to determine is that using this and handing it off to a team whose sole goal was to work on these patients is they could reduce the in-hospital mortality by about 16%. Now, you say, well, that seems pretty obvious. Well, there are two issues. One is getting the information. The second is, how do you handle that? And that's where this was particularly neat. They did all of this remotely. It identified people about 12 hours before they sent a rapid response team in to evaluate the patient, and then they would notify the doctor and nurses about this particular situation and what they might do. So it was a whole separate team that had no other responsibility other than working on these patients.
I think this is really cool because, speaking from the chaplain role, I would say that the deaths that are unexpected and take place on units other than the ICU are extremely disruptive in the hospital. And so I think some foreshadowing that this is a potential and that there's an intervention that's also possible is really helpful.
Elizabeth, I agree. Identifying them not at the time they're about to crash and need an ICU, but identifying them ahead of time. Again, having access to a rapid response team that's staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to prevent not only 30-day mortality, but also decreased ICU usage and also hospital stay as well.
We'll look forward to some more expansion of this one. Finally, let's turn to Lancet Psychiatry. One of the sequela of COVID-19 infection, it appears from this study, that it could be a diagnosis of a psychiatric illness. That's concerning, of course. We're all looking at what happens to these folks if they survive COVID-19 infection. They took a look at 69 million people, about 62,000 plus of whom had a diagnosis of COVID-19. And they said, are these folks more likely to have an increased rate of subsequent psychiatric diagnosis? Also looked at whether patients with a history of psychiatric illness were at a higher risk of being diagnosed with COVID-19. Sure enough, they did find that a diagnosis of COVID-19 was associated with increased incidence of a first psychiatric diagnosis in the 14 to 90 days following that diagnosis. And they compared that with six other health events. I won't name all of them, but influenza, other respiratory tract infections, and so on. This risk was greatest for anxiety disorders, which makes a lot of sense to me, insomnia, which also makes sense, and then dementia, which is a little bit less sensical, at least in my mind. And a previous psychiatric diagnosis was associated with a higher relative risk of being diagnosed with COVID-19. So among all of the constellation of things we need to pay attention to, it sounds like we need to pay attention to this too.
And let's put some numbers with this. As you said, this is measured in the first 14 to 90 days after infection. So they've cleared the infection. So these are some of the residual complications. The incidence of any psychiatric diagnosis in those time period after COVID diagnosis was about 18%, including about 6% of those, that was their first diagnosis. It did not increase the risk of psychosis or schizophrenia. So Elizabeth, do you think that this is a direct effect on the brain, or do you think that these are environmental issues that are causing this?
You know, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that. And I think the only thing that's going to tell us that is going to be long-term data. It was not surprising to me at all that anxiety disorders might follow an infection such as COVID-19, especially if you were hospitalized or had pretty critical or even moderate illness. Similarly, I think the insomnia diagnosis makes a lot of sense. With regard to dementia, as you already said, in older people, we know that frequently we see this sort of unmasking of incipient dementia in people who have those kinds of assaults to their system. So maybe that's not surprising either. I don't know. But I would like to see more long-term data.
And Elizabeth, that's why they use this particular study and compared it to other significant illnesses, like you said, influenza and respiratory illnesses and other conditions that cause hospitalization, even surgery as well. But the incidence of behavioral issues associated with COVID seemed to be about twice the incidence of even those other significant hospital stays. So, Elizabeth, I wish I knew the answer too, but it certainly means that if about one out of five people are going to experience a psychiatric disorder after COVID infection, we need to be aware of it, screen for it, and treat it as appropriately.
Ah, yes. When we get time to turn to things that are so wonderful as sequela. On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lyon. Y'all listen up. Make healthy choices.